You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Manuel toko ingoa, nau mai, hari mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rapa Wednesday. I am your host, Manny, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in studio by my producers, Toby and Theo. For our FI Akane, coming up on the show for our weekly catch-up with the Green Party, I spoke with MP Ricardo Menendez-March about the call for a budgetary office, the growing wealth disparity, and workers' rights. Toby, what do you have for us today?
I spoke to Dr. Chris Wilson and Michael Jawolski about their new book, He Told Us, examining the 2019 Christchurch terrorist attack.
And Theo, what do you have for us today?
I spoke to the Executive Director of Transparency International New Zealand, Julie Haggie, on the regulation of political donations in Aotearoa New Zealand. For this week's Get Action, I spoke to the Sudan Advocacy Network Aotearoa's Fatima Sanusi on their petition to urgently establish a Sudan special humanitarian visa pathway.
He aha o whakaaro, we'd love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces today, so get in touch. Tuku patahi mai, text in on 5395. Kaua e wareware e ahi ana koutou, te whakarongo ana ki ane kororo anō. Hei pikehere rukiruki marunga e te pai tukutuku o irangi poho, me haere ki 95BFM irekati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
How big is his hole? And do...
That is not in the public interest, I can assure you.
The Wire.
Now it's time to hear from the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March.
While the election is still over 4 months away, parties are already deploying what has become an election period staple, the budget hole. The idea that a party vying for government may have bungled the numbers is quite the attack. But without every Kiwi trying to break the numbers themselves, we often have to take at least someone at their word. The Green Party is among a number of voices proposing a fix to this, a parliamentary budget office that would vet costs of party policies and be able to answer that age-old question, how big is their hole. And ahead of the release of their own tax policy, the Greens have highlighted that the richest 150 New Zealand individuals and family dynasties now own as much as half of the country between them. These numbers from the National Business Review show that this small group of Kiwis grew their collective wealth from $102 billion to $129 billion just last year. That's a 26% increase in 1 year. As the current government gives tax breaks to landlords and cuts to social services, the Green Party says they would be looking at this growth instead. But how do they propose we claw that wealth back? For our weekly catch-up with the Green Party, I spoke with MP Ricardo Menendez-March about their call for a parliamentary budget office, the growing wealth disparity, and workers' rights. Morena, Ricardo, how's it going?
Morena, thanks for having me. I'm good, thank you.
I want to start our conversation today with the Greens' call for a parliamentary budget office. There are often claims during an election time of budget holes and different budgeting things, and also of the difficulty it is for opposition parties to even present a budget without knowing or without having the support that the government gets. So is this the motivation behind the budgetary office, or are there other things going on here?
No, this is a pretty straightforward proposal. We've actually held this position for quite some terms now, and it does come from the fact that we believe New Zealanders should have access to all the information they need to make up their minds on which political parties to support. And one of the challenges that exists is that unless you have access to the public service to do the maths for you, opposition political parties often don't have access to the resources to be able to cost their proposals and their policies, leaving voters, with headlines and accusations from opponents, basically on claims of fiscal holes or people not having done the adequate maths. And so this would actually even the playing field, but it would put more scrutiny on political parties to actually run their numbers through and make sure that they're transparent about what their proposals entail and who is affecting those various proposals and what are the fiscal ramifications of them. So we hope that Labour and National can get behind.
It doesn't seem particularly ideological in the call as well, in a sense. It doesn't seem like it's just coming from one side. It would make sense for other parties to support it. Is there any reason why this hasn't happened yet?
I think it's a common sense proposal. It feels like it's political inertia from the legacy parties. And, I mean, we've even had Finance Minister Nicola Willis supporting such proposals before, but I think it's inertia, and it baffles me that neither Labour or National want to commit to it, because ultimately this would be a really good opportunity to stop the accusations from each side over fiscal holes and or gaps in policy proposals. But you know, every political party may find themselves in a position at one point in their political life, and having access to a parliamentary budget office, like I said, would give voters more information over parties' proposal. So like, it's a pretty straightforward, simple solution, and having a parliamentary budget office shouldn't cost much, but it would really enrich the political debate and access to information for voters as well on proposals.
I want to move on now to our next topic. In the lead up to what I understand to be the Green Party's launch of their tax policy, I've noticed through your press releases, there's been an emphasis and highlighting on the growth of wealth of New Zealand's rich listers, of the 150 richest people in the country. And I'd like to delve into this with you. What is alarming for the Green Party in these numbers?
Yeah, look, wealth inequality in this country is skyrocketing, and this really does show that whenever the government tells us that there's no money to go around, what they're not really telling us is that actually there is money. It's just being hoarded by a handful of families. And the latest report shows that about 150 New Zealand individuals and dynasties now basically own between them as much as half the country. And so while people are struggling to make ends meet, while homelessness increases, we've seen the super rich actually increase their wealth by around over 25% just in 1 year. And this amounts to $129 billion now. And what this tells us is that if we fix the tax system, if we actually tax the wealthy few adequately, we would be able to fund access to better healthcare, more housing, better quality jobs, and the things that people need to do well.
In the current electoral cycle, there's been talks about the National Party gearing up to campaign on the sale of some New Zealand assets, such as potentially looking at Kiwi Bank, although I don't think they've confirmed that yet. When the New Zealand government is talking about selling off the assets that they do own on behalf of the whole New Zealand public, but they're not looking at where a lot of this wealth is going, I feel like we've seen a lot of this before. How do those things sort of combine?
Well, it just tells us that this government is thinking in the short term, and selling assets has never resulted in actual long-term better outcomes for people or lower bills for that matter. And so what this tells us is that right now we've got a government that is quite happy to see wealth inequality increase while selling our very own assets that allow us to have good lives to those very same people that are making a huge buck while everybody else is being told to tighten up and save more money. And this tells us once again that what we're dealing with is a rigged system where if you're a wealthy few, you can pour hundreds of thousands of dollars into the political parties that back billionaires remaining super rich while everyday people struggle to make ends meet. And once again, what this tells us is that we've got an opportunity, though, to fix the tax system to adequately tax the wealthy few and make sure that we can actually fund the very same public services like healthcare, public housing, and create good jobs so that people can have good lives. And this also tells us, that people are being currently taxed too much for their work, but that if you're a billionaire and you're hiding your assets, through property and et cetera, you can just continue to get richer despite those very same assets not necessarily producing anything for everyday people.
Not to jump the gun on what the Greens are going to propose, but would you be interested in just now we can do a quick run through of different potential taxes and you can tell me what's right or what's wrong with them and whether or not they will address this problem?
So, well, look, if you look at our previous policy proposals, you will know that we've long campaigned to ensure that the assets of the wealthy few are adequately taxed. And when we say wealthy few, we mean, the multi-millionaires. And one of the other things that we've long held as a proposal is to rebalance the income tax system. If you look at Australia, for example, we do have tax-free bracket for the first few $1,000 that you earn. And we think that this is something that should be looked at. And ultimately, we've long held the position that we need to actually tax work less and tax wealth more. And so just a few days to go before you find out exactly what we're proposing.
A party like the top party has long campaigned on a land value tax. What is the Green Party's position on this? Why was this not something that the Green Party would be interested in taking up?
Yeah, look, you'll get to hear more about exactly what we'll propose
over
the weekend.
But what I will say
is that if voters want a government that is actually committed to taxing the wealthy few and to change the government, the Opportunity Party cannot be trusted because there is no way that they'll get those taxes across by siding with the National Party, which is something that the Opportunity Party has long played with. And so this is why we'll be making it clear to voters that our mission is not just to change the government, but to bring about a government of change. And I just cannot see how we could actually tax the wealthy few and have a fair tax system by making up a government with the National Party. And I just don't see that as a possibility when they've shown us time and time again that they're quite interested in growing wealth inequality and allowing the rich to get richer at the expense of everybody else.
There's been an element to the capital gains tax as well that, whilst useful in beginning to tax a lot of these things, might not cover this huge growth in wealth of these 150 richest people.
Well, that's right. And the issue with a capital gains tax is also the time that it takes to adequately bring revenue to in order to fund the services that we need. We've long proposed an overhaul of the tax system so that, A, we address the growing wealth inequality and the fact that we've got billionaires that are hoarding the resources, stopping people from actually having what they need to do well. And a capital gains tax just does not go far enough into addressing the reality that we do not have a cost of living crisis. We have a cost of greed crisis, where the wealthy few are being allowed to hoard all the resources and their wealth and stopping people from actually having what they need to do, okay? And we've seen how that is starting to destroy the fabric of societies, like in the United States, where there's people who are literally dying because they cannot have access to life-saving medication, while the United States is effectively richer than it's ever been, and its citizens are literally struggling to access basic health care. And so this tells us that the system is working in the favor of the wealthy few, not everyday citizens.
The Green Party put out a press release on their website about the New Zealand government supporting US policy in the international stage against other Western nations. And this was about the support for gig workers. Could you help explain this to our listeners a little bit?
Yeah, look, I'm sure many listeners have had to use Uber services every now and then, right? And what people may not know is that right now, companies like Uber do not treat drivers particularly well. This has been well documented in court cases, and most of the profits get taken offshore. There's been court cases that were successful that basically would have ensured that Uber drivers get better protections, and the government legislated against that. And now they have sided with the United States and mega corporates to stop gig workers, for example, Uber drivers, from having better rights. And this is embarrassing because a lot of nations are realizing that their citizens do not win when we've got mega corporates ripping us off, taking their profits offshore and treating workers absolutely poorly. And this has been well documented. Uber drivers often face precarious conditions, and I think we can do better. And so this just shows that we are choosing to take on the side of the United States when it comes to issues around workers' rights. And unfortunately, the United States is siding with the mega corporates that are getting richer while those very same workers struggle to make ends meet. It could be different. And I think we just need to change the government in order to start taking positions that are actually on the side of workers and not mega corporates.
All right. Well, let's wrap things up here then. Thank you very, very much for joining me this morning, Ricardo.
Appreciate it, Manuel. Thank you.
That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March discussing the Greens' call for a parliamentary budget office, the growing wealth disparity and how to tax it, and the rights of gig workers. Please let us know your thoughts on any of these interviews today. So text in on 5395 or call us on 309 3879.
That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March.
This is Hoo Ha by Christoph El Truinto. We'll be right back after this break.
Ela senta, senta, ela quica. Aqui no baile o clima tá gostosinho. A ousadia desenvolve aos pouquinhos. Ela senta, senta, ela quica. Aqui no baile o clima tá gostosinho. A ousadia desenvolve aos pouquinhos. Ela senta, senta, ela quica. Aqui no baile o clima tá gostosinho. A ousadia desenvolve aos pouquinhos. Ela senta, senta, ela quica, quica, ela quica. Aqui no baile o clima tá gostosinho. A ousadia desenvolve aos pouquinhos. Ela senta, senta, ela quica. Aqui no baile o clima tá gostosinho. A ousadia desenvolve aos pouquinhos. Ela senta, senta, ela quica. Aqui no baile o clima tá gostosinho. A ousadia desenvolve aos pouquinhos. Ela senta, senta, ela quica. Aqui no baile o clima tá gostosinho. A ousadia desenvolve aos pouquinhos. Ela senta, senta, ela quica. Aqui no baile o clima tá gostosinho. Ela senta, senta, ela. baixo ela quer, por cima ela quer, por baixo ela quer, por cima ela quis, ela fica, ela quer, por baixo ela quer, por cima ela quer, por baixo ela quer, por cima ela quer, por baixo ela quer, por cima ela quis. Aqui no baile o clima tá gostosinho, a ousadia desenvolve aos pouquinhos. Ela senta, ela quita. Aqui no baile o clima tá gostosinho, a ousadia desenvolve aos pouquinhos. Ela senta, ela quita.
Wow, we get along so well. I feel like I've known you my whole life.
I know, it's crazy. I'd love to see you again.
Sorry, I just have to ask. Your hoodie is so random. What is 95BFM?
Oh, I knew this was too good to be true.
What? Wait, where are you going?
No!
Show the world exactly who you are with our range of classic 95BFM merch. From the BSA slogan t-shirt to ringer tees and hoodies, get yours now at twotonesmerch.co.nz.
The worms better watch their back.
Sometimes you need a bit of uns.
That snooze button better be disarmed.
I like it. It's making my eyelid twitch. Love it.
And the wrong side of the bed better shuffle over.
And they're just so beautifully, like, menstrual.
Because we've got a little something for your gratitude journal.
Cowbella.
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 It's the 95BFM Breakfast Show with your hosts, Rosetta and Millie. 7 till 10 every weekday. Thanks to 8:30 Coffee Roasters.
Hey, Captain, do you think we'll ever find the land of the good groove?
Patience, Sonny Jim.
It's just, we've been floating on this dinghy for months, since the crew mutiny.
Patience, Sonny Jim.
It's concerning that you keep repeating that. I don't even think my name is Sonny Jim. Is that my name? Captain?
Patience, Captain. Sonny Jim.
I am Sonny Jim. We are both Sonny Jim. Lando, we made it. Let's drink some more seawater to celebrate.
Land of the Good Groove with Murray Kamek. Bringing a solid hour of funk, electricity and soul to your Friday afternoons. It's time to move. Time to get loose. Anywhere you are. Land of the Good Groove, 1 till 2 p.m. every Friday, right here on 95BFM.
Before the break was Hoo Ha by Christoph El Truento. Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM. Please let us know your thoughts on any of these pieces today. Text in on 5395 or call us on 309 3879.
For old time's sake, yes or no, would you like to be leader of the National Party at some point?
No, I'm just focused on what I'm doing. I'm one of those people that do it day by day, job by job.
I'll save this clip and come back to it in 5 or 10 years. We'll see how it's aged.
The Wire. We're well into the election year, with spats across the political aisle and even within the government on the up. Similarly rising are the political donations received by these parties. So far, the ACT Party is leading the pack with over $1.35 million in donations exceeding $20,000, well above the National Party, which trails in at just over $720,000. However, concerns have continued to be raised at the lack of regulation and transparency for political donations in Aotearoa New Zealand. Transparency International New Zealand have called our laws around political donations some of the weakest in the world, with the threshold for reporting donations far higher than many comparable OECD nations, and with no limiting cap on donations. So, to learn more about the state of our regulation of political donations in New Zealand, I spoke to the Executive Director of Transparency International New Zealand, Julie Haggie. Kia ora, Julie. So, starting off, what's the big issue with political donations?
It is okay for people to donate. I think it's what's important is to have a reasonable balance around the impact of donations compared to the vote. And I think that's why a lot of countries have put in controls on donations, for many reasons, really. One is to stop overseas influence on elections. One is to stop an uneven balance on public policy. And the other is just to support general democracy, as everybody has a fair go, all parties and political parties have a fair go, rather than having more power over the voting booth when you've got more money. So that's why we need some controls. And New Zealand lags far behind other countries in the OECD. Our sort of comparable peers, we lag far behind in several really important elements. One is the cap on donations. That's a real big problem. We have a problem about third-party promoters being allowed to do what they want in New Zealand, which are controlled in other countries. And the third is kind of when the voters know who's doing what. So actual transparency on political donations. It's got some elements that are good, but it's got some that are really poor as well. Like, we don't really find out. The majority of donations we really don't find out about until 6 months after the election's finished.
Right, yeah, and New Zealand's score on Transparency International's Corruption Perceptions Index has continued to drop over the last few years. To what extent do political donations and our regulation around them play a role in that?
You can't draw a direct line. So there's not a question in any of those contributing surveys to the Corruption Perceptions Index about donations. But there is about the level of, there are questions around whether contracts are being awarded based on money being paid. And so there is also some evidence from some surveys that believe that government is being influenced strongly by big donors through surveys. So I think there is enough to say that that is a concern of the population, that there is too much influence. And when you look at the actual donations that are coming through, I mean, there's been a massive increase in money coming through political parties this year. And I know it costs a lot to run a political party and to, you know, run an election, but there's been 14 million in donations through to 2025, so that's up 40%, and the biggest non-election year haul on record. So clearly people are using, and some people are using that in order to power up their political campaign, obviously. But also there's a huge increase in the number of third-party promoters. You would have seen, people would have seen these sort of groups appearing on the internet that around New Zealand that seem to be promoting some particular issue. A large part, many of them will be funded by third-party promoters. And that's, they don't have to do any declarations. They have to put their name on their advertising, but they don't have to do any declarations. They don't have any caps on the amount of spending. So they can have a huge influence on sort of what's happening in the social space, how people are feeling, you know, driving up the emotion, the kind of angertainment thing that's happening in New Zealand spaces at the moment. And they can have a huge influence, and there's no control. Also, you could have foreign funders actually paying for those third-party promoters and with no transparency about it at all. And there are controls on those around the world. So we're just way behind there. So we're missing, as often happens with New Zealand, we're kind of missing out on the trends because we are just a bit sluggish around our legislation. So we need change.
Right. So, I mean, I guess digging into the weeds on that, I mean, I know that donations of $20,000 or more need to be declared, but I mean, are there any other kind of restrictions on political donations in New Zealand right now?
Yes, there are some. So anybody, you have to be, anything over $20,000 has to be declared, and other donations over 15, and that's like declared within 20 days, and usually the Electoral Commission publishes that pretty promptly. That's a really good initiative, and it happened, it's been a good initiative. There's no cap on the amount any individual organisation can donate, and that's a problem when you've got basically a few business people actually being the largest donors across any parties. And, you know, they're sort of dominating the donor space. So that's a bit of an issue. We also have a donations protected from disclosure mechanism, which means you can actually donate more than $15,000 anonymously, but it goes through the Electoral Commission with your intent on who is it to go through. Now, it's just a mystery about why we've got that. There's a cap for $400,000, but that's, you know, that's already up there at the moment. So is that's another way people are using to actually count it, go get around the system. So I think there's lots of there is transparency on those who donate over $5,000 and under $20,000, but that we don't hear about that till for a very, until a very long time, after, 6 months after the election. It should be real time. In the overseas, in Queensland, they've got a great model where anybody over a certain amount, I think it's about over 200 or 400 or something, or maybe 500, their name goes on, it's all automatically in the system, and people can see who's voting for what using a simple, you know, the simple kind of online tool that's publicly available. So, you know, that's what we need in New Zealand. It's easily able to be done now. It's not hard. So we should have that, so people can see who's voting, who's paying for what ahead of the election.
Jumping in some of those points you raised earlier about organisations and companies, I mean, let's talk loopholes. What are some of the ways that political donations are slipping past without that level of scrutiny that we kind of need?
Well, we think there probably is quite a lot because we don't know. We don't know because there's no declaration, no transparency of it, but we think there is quite a lot probably happening around the third-party promoters. And that'll be people paying other people to do work on the internet, for example, and just paying them in some other way. So we don't have any visibility of that, nor any regulation around it. So it's a real problem. We've got a regulation against foreign donations, but we don't have. But people can still get round. There's still a loophole they can get round to just pay somebody else. It's in New Zealand, and other countries do have that in place. So we should be putting that in place. And we don't have. Caps on the amounts, it's a really big problem about having caps on the actual amounts that people are putting through. So very, very large donations. And then you're seeing some of them this year, there's some reporting about donations connected to people applying for fast track legislation. Some countries have regulations in place that say companies that are currently in negotiations or applying or have contracts cannot make a donation. Some countries have rules that say no companies, no unions can make any donations at all, so that it's only on individual persons' donations. And so that's, you know, those are means that we should be looking at, but there's just so little energy and will of any political party to do it. And there has been a bit happened in the previous administration, but still it needs to be so much clearer and clearer for everybody involved, so that a person's vote, everybody's vote has the same power, and everybody's donation has a reasonable level of influence, you know, that support rather than actually influence.
Would you put that level of, I guess, inaction down to a reluctance to really harm their own political party? I mean, if the big political parties are receiving these donations, is there much in it for them to look into this regulation?
Yeah, that's right. That is the problem. So people have got to take an ethical view on what's happening to themselves. It might mean a restriction in the amount that comes into their party coffers and to their individual candidate coffers. But that applies across all sorts of things at Parliament. You know, we also need to have lobbying regulation. But again, the politicians are reluctant to do it because it has a direct input on how they behave and how they expect other people to behave around them. And that is a real problem we've got in New Zealand, with that ethical lens, that integrity lens by political parties and political candidates is seen as, oh, we really need that money to run our campaign, not how much should we have, is this reasonable, why do we need caps, why do we need controls? You know, and having that conversation about the impact on democracy is what doesn't happen at Parliament, and I think that really needs to occur. And it needs to occur, it also needs to happen through citizens just saying it to their parliamentarians, saying it publicly, and speaking out, you know, at any political meeting, and just saying, why aren't you supporting tighter political donations regulations?
So in terms of ways that we could go about this, I mean, some people have floated the idea of each political party receiving a certain allocation of election kind of funds to campaign. Would that be feasible, to just remove political donations from that equation entirely?
Yeah, that's one option. I mean, the political parties actually do get some funding, which they can use on advertising through the parliamentary funding. So there is some funding going through already. That's an option. I mean, Transparency International hasn't come down that hard. I know some others have. I think we just think there ought to be really clear caps. So we think donation caps. We think lower the disclosure thresholds as well, so there's more transparency. like write down to so it, to for a donor's identity to be disclosed, and then restrict some of the eligible donors. So maybe just registered New Zealand voters, exclude corporates, unions, may ban corporate donations, perhaps. Have third-party promoter transparency and real-time disclosure, and strengthen sort of some of the means at Parliament to explicitly address conflicts of interest where there's a donor involved in a conversation, in a decision. So I think that those are sort of areas that we could actually put in place as a measure and then see how we go. At the moment, we're really just open slather, and it definitely needs some controls.
That was the Executive Director of Transparency International New Zealand, Julie Haggie, on the regulation of political donations in Aotearoa, New Zealand.
It's time to get action with Action Station Aotearoa, the segment where we chat with the people campaigning for a fairer future.
Sudan has been suffering under a war between its army and the paramilitary group called the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, for over 3 years now, with outside nations fueling the conflict. The nation is facing a severe humanitarian crisis, with over 33.7 million people in need of humanitarian assistance. Widespread violence against civilians is ongoing, including systematic sexual violence against women and girls. The United Nations has identified hallmarks and indicators consistent with genocide, such as ethnically targeted violence and atrocity crimes. However, advocates have pointed to a conspicuous absence of international attention to this crisis. In New Zealand, the Sudan Advocacy Network Aotearoa is calling for New Zealand to welcome Sudanese refugees to our shores. Part of that is a petition that is calling for the creation of a special Sudanese visa that would streamline Sudanese refugees entering New Zealand. So, to discuss this petition, I spoke with Fatima Sanusi on their petition to establish this special visa. Kia ora, Fatima. So, the war in Sudan entered its fourth year a little over 2 months ago. So, starting off, can you tell us a bit about what Sudanese civilians have been facing for the last 3 years?
For the last 3 years, Sudanese civilians, honestly, are facing unimaginable conditions. Millions have been forced from their homes. Families have been separated across cities, regions, and international borders. People are struggling to access food, to access clean water, healthcare, and education. Hospitals have been attacked. Schools have been shut down, and entire communities are left without basic needs and services. As we head entering our fourth year of war in Sudan, more than 33.7 million people require humanitarian assistance. 12 million people have been displaced from their homes, and we're looking at about 25 million people that face acute food insecurity, and more than 15 million children that require humanitarian support, and about 17 million that are out of school. That's about 3 times the population of New Zealand, to give an understanding of the scale of the situation in Sudan right now. And despite the scale of suffering, it still remains one of the most overlooked humanitarian crises in the world, although it's the most severe, and it's the largest displacement crisis. And for Sudanese that are in New Zealand, these are not just statistics. These are our parents, our siblings, our grandparents, our loved ones, our families. And every day our community lives with that fear of receiving devastating news and desperately, while also trying to desperately support their families, being trapped in between these conflict zones. Drone warfare has been the everyday for Sudanese for the last 3 years, and complete devastation to Sudan's infrastructure and stability.
So I guess linking to that point you made about how it's been really overlooked by the international community, in your petition, you call for a special visa modelled on the one created for Ukrainians back in 2022 when the Russian invasion began. Now, that pathway opened a little under 3 weeks after the Russian invasion of Ukraine began. We're well over 3 years since the war in Sudan began. Why do you think we haven't seen a similar pathway for Sudanese refugees in New Zealand?
Exactly, and I think that's an integral question that us Sudanese in Aotearoa are trying to understand ourselves, and that's an answer I believe that our government can only give us. And I do believe there's a lot of double standard in this when it comes to conflicts, particularly in Africa, where there's a bit of, I believe, a war fatigue around this, around conflicts in Africa due to how they're framed, which is a very integral part of mobilizing action and also getting a response. And the war in Sudan has been constantly framed in a lens of a civil war when it actually has proxy elements and it's fueled and sustained by external actors, particularly the United Arab Emirates. And so that is even more of a reason, I believe, for the New Zealand government to act on the situation in Sudan as well as support the Sudanese communities here, given the diplomatic relations New Zealand and the United Arab Emirates have, particularly through their $1 billion trade deal. And I think what it reinforces to us Sudanese is that our safety can be compromised. This is an attack on civilians. This is not a civil war, and I genuinely do believe that the framing of what's happening in Sudan is refraining the proper response towards the situation, and as well as to and is delaying also the response to our communities and the responsibility our government also has to our communities. And we modeled the proposal on the Ukraine special visa because it demonstrates that New Zealand can respond quickly. As you said, it only took 3 weeks. And we're going into our fourth year, and our community did have a submission to the government calling for a special humanitarian visa pathway, which was thrown out by our last government. And so this is us going for a second push, and I guess the Ukraine pathway was integral because it showed us that New Zealand has both the capacity and willingness, right, to create targeted humanitarian pathways when families are separated by war. And so we fully supported that response, and our position is simple. Humanitarian responses should be guided by need, and right now Sudan is the most severe humanitarian crisis in the world, and I think New Zealand can have a principled response to the situation and support Sudanese communities in Aotearoa that are impacted by being separated by their families as well as the devastation and it's caused to them in throughout the last 3 years.
Right, and in your petition, you've also, aside from the special visa pathway, you've called for a greater proportion of our refugee quota to be allocated to Sudanese refugees. Now, currently, the New Zealand refugee quota is only 1,500 people, which is small, even when we consider it on a per capita basis. Now, from 2025 to 2028, our quota has essentially put aside 20% of that to the entire continent of Africa. Is that enough?
Given the situation, the severe situation right now, I don't believe that it's enough. Like I said, Sudan is currently facing one of the world's largest displacement crises. Relatively few Sudanese refugees have actually had access to durable pathways of safety. We believe that New Zealand can actually allocate more of a meaningful portion of its refugee intakes of Sudanese in particular, given the situation at the time.
Now, the petition also calls for the pathway for Sudanese refugees to be accessible, fast-tracked and trauma-informed, with the removal of unnecessary bureaucratic barriers that delay reunification in emergency contexts. Now, currently, we've got legislation making its way through Parliament, the Immigration Enhanced Risk Management Amendment Bill, which commentators such as the University of Auckland's Professor Jay Marlowe and Dr. Timothy Fadgen have pointed to being significantly contributing to a shift away from a humanitarian orientation towards refugees to one of suspicion and control. With that in mind, I guess, how would you characterise New Zealand's current approach to refugees, specifically Sudanese refugees, and why is it important that we act in accordance to the human rights and refugee treaties that we've signed?
I think it's given our time right now, when we look at the global world and with the wars occurring all over the world and the greater demand, I guess, to find pathways of peace throughout the whole world, it's a very integral time to shape our humanitarian, not only shape our humanitarian responses, but also have a stance on where we stand in terms of human rights. And we've clearly seen that humanitarian law and human rights law has failed to be an instrument of peace, whether it's through its inability to stop genocides from occurring, multiple genocides live streamed throughout the world, or to bring justice and accountability. I think New Zealand has may not have the geopolitical power or will to stop a lot of these wars or atrocities from ending, but can have a principled stance in the way that we respond and the way that we receive refugees, particularly with in mind, given that these are individuals that are in the crossfires of a war that wars that they have nothing to do with. And they are individuals with dreams and with hopes, with families, and with and are caught up in essentially a global war economy, to be truthfully honest. And so Sudanese, as a Sudanese, with the situation that's happening in Sudan, as I always point to reframing and understanding what's actually happening in Sudan, because what's happening in Sudan is fueled by external influences, with the support of diplomatic cover by the West. It's multinational corporations. It's a lot of factors contributing to the devastation and impacts on innocent civilians that have nothing to do with this, but it sustains a global war economy and a global economy, essentially.
That was the Sudan Advocacy Network Aotearoa's Fatima Sanusi on their petition to establish a Sudan special humanitarian visa pathway for Sudanese communities in Aotearoa who have direct or extended family members displaced and affected by the ongoing war in Sudan. If you'd like to sign this petition, you can find it on the Action Station website or in the description for this interview on our BCast page.
That was Get Action with Action Station Aotearoa.
Well, what a phenomenal thing for you to say.
The Wire.
7 years ago, New Zealand suffered the worst terrorist attack in its history when an Australian white nationalist entered two different mosques in the city of Christchurch and shot 51 Muslim worshippers to death, injuring 89 others. Last week, a new book was published entitled He Told Us, co-written by Chris Wilson and Mikhail Dzivulski. The book documents the life of the terrorist and the lead-up to the attack, the ideologies and online communities that influenced him, the atrocities he committed on the day, and the aftermath, with a focus on the Royal Commission and its limitations. Dr. Chris Wilson is an Associate Professor in Politics and International Relations at the University of Auckland, and Mikhail Dzivulski is a researcher currently studying a Master's degree in Conflict and Terrorism Studies, also at the University of Auckland. They joined me in the studio this morning to discuss what we've learned and what we failed to learn from this horrendous attack. To begin with the basics, what is He Told Us actually about, and how do you hope that the publication of this book will affect the public's understanding of the events that took place on the 15th of March 2019?
The book is really a a comprehensive picture of the attack and the perpetrator, and how and who he was, why he committed that atrocity, and then the white nationalist you know, transnational and but particularly Australian white nationalist movement that, of which he was a part, and the online spaces that he inhabited and the effect that they have on people. His attack and then the investigation and the Royal Commission of Inquiry that followed after it, which was supposed to be a comprehensive inquiry into how he was able to plan his attack and conduct it, and was there anything that could have been done to stop it? That's what was initially announced. But you know, as we show in the book, that the terms of the inquiry were narrowed substantially to make it that we really learned nothing. And so by the time we started, we looked at the Royal Commission report and went, our knowledge of what has happened here is really, really incomplete. So we set to work trying to find him, trying to find his online record, trying to understand him properly. And we hope that that information, on the second part of your question, we hope that that information changes New Zealanders' understanding of what happened, who he was, why he did what he did, and what could be done in the future to stop similar atrocities. And also globally as well. It's, you know, it's the most influential far-right terrorist attack now that's occurred and continues to inspire other people, incite other people to violence across the world, so we have to understand it.
People will remember that in the immediate aftermath of the attack, most of the media followed the example set by Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern and avoided referring to the terrorist by name. In your book, you mostly follow this example, simply referring to him as the terrorist. However, you don't completely censor his name either and use it a number of times throughout the book. What are the advantages and disadvantages of referring to perpetrators of terrorist acts by name? And what was the rationale for the approach that you used in the book?
So it's broadly understood that, you know, you don't use the perpetrator's name because that can lead to glorification of the person and the act. But that is also sort of based on quite an old understanding from legacy media days, where there was a single sort of point of news, so people would sort of hear about something happening and then it would be broadcast through there. Things have changed a lot with social media, so even if there's a censorship of the name and of certain details in sort of legacy media and mainstream media, there's a lot of channels out there where the details and the information can be spread anyway. So there's kind of these two worlds that exist, and so we had to sort of acknowledge that. You know, when you have the leader of the country sort of stepping up and saying, we're not going to say his name, we're not going to do it. There's an unintended consequence there around giving people permission to turn away from what happened.
Hmm.
And by not saying his name, you're not going to look at what happened, you're not going to examine it. And so we feel that that's contributed to a forgetting of what happened, and many of the families and the community that we spoke to felt the same way.
But and I would just add that, but as you say, we do stick to that guideline out of respect for the families.
In this book, you frequently emphasise the Australian-ness of the terrorist. The subtitle of the book is How an Australian Committed Far-Right Terrorism in Christchurch, New Zealand. And the longest chapter of the book deals specifically with the background of white nationalism in Australia. But given that you also emphasise how in the age of the smartphone, white nationalism is an increasingly international phenomenon, how significant is the nationality of the terrorist really? And do you think that a similar act could not have been carried out by somebody born and raised in this country?
I think both things can be really important simultaneously, and both of them played off each other. The transnational and online nature of white nationalism across the globe, but also him being an Australian, being a proud Australian, emphasising his Australianness online, and being deeply connected and excited by a rising Australian far-right movement. A number of organisations growing in size, becoming more militant, holding rallies, preventing the building of mosques, gaining a lot of media, having a couple of charismatic leaders. All of these things excited him, and you could see that reflected in his online posting in anonymous transnational forums. So the two things played off each other, almost like his online world, which was this anonymous forum, 4chan, and particularly the poll Politically Incorrect board, was crucial to his radicalisation towards militancy and the attack. But he was also being excited by these offline events back in his home country. So they were both kind of like a almost like a double helix type effect in terms of pushing him towards the attack.
And coming back to your point about Australia and how important that is, so, you know, he grew up in Australia. As he travelled, you know, he maintained a very strong Australian identity and he was involved with all these Australian groups. When the Royal Commission of Inquiry looked into it, they didn't critique Australian security agencies. They, you know, they go into detail of the history of, you know, New Zealand agencies and, you know, what happened in the 1960s for these, you know, NZSIS and all of that. But they just let off the security agencies from Australia with a simple thing of just, you know, they told us that they didn't know anything about him, they didn't have any intelligence on him, and they sort of leave it at that. And Australia itself hasn't had any sort of reckoning with this terrorist or this event. So the fact that it happened in New Zealand is just, that's just a target that he chose.
One aspect of the terrorist's life that I was pretty surprised to learn about was his overseas travel. So correct me if I have the facts wrong, but I believe after the suicide of his father in 2010, he inherited a large sum of money, about $500,000, which he then used to travel across Europe, Asia and Africa, including several Muslim-majority countries. So what do we know about the terrorist's activity during his time overseas, and how did that contribute to the shaping of his worldview, and was he in contact with any other far-right actors in those countries?
Our primary source of information is the Royal Commission of Inquiry, which only discusses his travel in a few pages, really. So there's very little known about, you know, what he was doing in each particular country, and he travelled to 60 different countries, including North Korea, Iran, Russia, Ukraine. He went to a whole bunch of places.
So that didn't raise any flags when he was applying for a firearms licence? Or?
No, so that wasn't part of that at all. And that, you know, with that comparison earlier of what it would have been like for a young Muslim man who was arriving in the country and applying for a licence, those sorts of travel destinations probably would have raised some eyebrows and some other questions would have been asked. But for the terrorist, that just wasn't a concern. And that also emboldened him, we feel, you know, as he was travelling through different places and not being questioned and just, you know, stating that he was going to commit violence online and that the Australian government couldn't stop him. That just made him more and more, I guess, certain that he could commit an attack. And so then when he got to planning and he was a lot more confident.
Mm-hmm. He sort of had these fantasies about starting another war in former Yugoslavia. Was he posting from the former Yugoslavia when he was talking about those things?
Yeah, so he was in Croatia at one point, and the travel was really important for us determining and figuring out his anonymous online posts, because he had travelled to all these different countries, and on 4chan you can see the country that somebody is posting from.
Let's talk about that in more detail. So you include in the book many posts made on online forums, particularly 4chan, and particularly the poll board, the politically incorrect board, and one of the features of that board is that next to every post or comment it displays the flag of the country that the person is in. And you were able to use known information about where he was travelling to determine that it was likely the terrorist who made these posts. Could you just tell us a bit more about the kind of forensics behind that and how you identified those posts as being authored by him?
The main things are there's, for the forensic linguistic side of it, is, you know, he would not put a space after certain punctuation. So after a full stop or comma, he would omit putting a space in. So that was quite a rare sort of grammatical quirk that we noticed. He would use certain words. He would contract certain words together, like as well or at least, which was also uncommon. So we had a whole bunch of markers that we were able to put together for the forensic linguistic side of things, and then look at those countries that he travelled in, look at the travel dates, and then just look at the 4chan posts on the politically incorrect board that has those flags on there, and then narrow it down and then find what we were then able to say is most certainly him.
One of the big questions raised in the book, and we've already touched on it so far, is the extent to which the terrorist actually acted alone. We know that he was the only shooter active on that particular day in the city, despite some confused comments that he made to police. But you raised the possibility that he may have been aided by others in the lead-up to the shootings in quite a direct way. So what evidence do we actually have to suggest that he may not have been completely alone?
So he conducted the attack alone. We have no doubt about that. At the time, as you say, he said there are 20 shooters, so there are 9 shooters, and then eventually during the police interrogation that day got down to we started using the term I, and then, you know, basically admitted that he had acted alone. From that moment, that seems to have coloured the understanding of him, and he was treated as if, yes, he certainly committed the attack, but everything that the investigation found from that moment on indicated that he had prepared and planned and bought his weapons and funded himself and done everything himself. The problem for us that we identify in the book is that that conclusion is drawn incredibly confidently, and it's such a crucial conclusion, but it was done so in the absence of really crucial information.
3 days after the attack, a briefing document proposed that the inquiry should consider what the relevant government agencies knew or should have known about the terrorist in the lead-up to the event. And this was how the Prime Minister repeatedly explained the scope of the inquiry to the media. But how was the scope of the inquiry changed, and how did this affect our ability to learn the lessons we needed to learn from this attack?
So the starting point, as was announced by the Prime Minister, was an inquiry into what the agencies could or should have known about the terrorist before his attack, i.e. a broad-ranging inquiry into what was he doing, what possibly could they have known, and what were the opportunities, if any, for his detection. So a broad-ranging inquiry, that was what was announced by the Prime Minister. But over a very brief period of about 2 or 3 weeks, as the terms of reference for the inquiry were finalised, that could or should have known was deleted and was replaced only with what the security agencies knew about the terrorist and what actions did they take in response to that knowledge, to that information, i.e. did they know anything? If the answer's no, then probably they don't need to do anything.
And mostly they found that they didn't know anything, and therefore they acted
exactly
as well as they could have.
Exactly, but it's important to keep in mind that at that time, or like so about a month after the attack or so, the agencies already knew that they knew nothing. They already had looked and seen, did we know anything about this individual? No, we didn't. This is something that we highlight in the book, because if we want an inquiry into how something, the worst crime in New Zealand's history, could have happened, and could it possibly have been prevented? Not so much to blame anybody, to blame any agencies or any individuals, then we need to focus on what could or should have been known. But that was removed. For us, it meant that the inquiry was incredibly narrow. It meant that we've learnt very little. You can, and as we do in the book, we compare it to inquiries into the terrorist attack in Norway and elsewhere, where there was a much more broad-ranging inquiry, there was much more criticism, and the country learnt a lot more. New Zealand was left with very little information and therefore nothing to change.
And importantly, it's the public perception of what was going to be investigated was really formulated in those early days. So, you know, the Prime Minister, the Minister of Police, the Police Commissioner, everybody was coming out saying no stone would be left unturned. You know, everybody recognised what an immense tragedy it was, and there was a huge outpouring of grief and love and support for the community. And so everybody had that demand of, well, we really need to understand what's happened here and learn from it. But within those sort of 3 or 4 weeks, those terms had changed, and then by the time the commission began its work, it had a very narrow task.
Which was never announced,
and
of course.
Yeah, it was never changed.
The change was never announced.
Yeah, so the initial could or should have known was announced. The change was made, that was never announced. And this is something that New Zealand needs to reckon with. The worst ever crime in New Zealand's history has not been considered properly. New Zealand has not considered how it was able to happen, what are the changes we need to make to avoid an atrocity like this in the future. It's absolutely crucial that the job is done properly.
That was Dr. Chris Wilson and Mikhail Javulski from the University of Auckland.
The Wire. That was The Wire.
Ko ira te ho taka katoa mo tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa e kororo mai ki mātou mo tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rapa Wednesday. Thank you to all of our guests, the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March, Transparency International New Zealand's Julie Heyi, Sudan Advocacy Network Aotearoa's Fatima Sanusi, and the University of Auckland's Dr. Chris Wilson and Michael Javulski. Nei rā hoki, te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongoa ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is The 1 to 4 with Alex. See you next week.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.